Greetings to our global neighbors and all the ships at sea. From coast to coast, border to border, this is Message Traffic from Washington, D.C., presented by the New York Center for Foreign Policy Affairs. We know the world is hearing about Paul Rusesabagina's guilty conviction today, as ordered by a judge in a Rwandan courtroom on September 20th, 2021. Although this episode was recorded months ago, we want to post this podcast now so that the world can be informed on the ins and outs of Paul's case from his daughter Karine and Paul's team here in the United States. Our organization has been working with Paul Rusesabagina's foundation and family and legal team since his illegal rendition from an airport in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, to custody in Rwanda. You best know Paul from the movie Hotel Rwanda. Mr. Rusesabagina saved more than 1,200 Tutsis and others in his position as the manager of Hotel des Mille Collines during the Rwandan genocide. He even received the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President George W. Bush. Paul Rusesabagina is a humanitarian who has regularly criticized human rights violations and the lack of democracy in Rwanda under President Kagame. His arrest came after calls for change. Everyone sees the headlines that he was guilty of terrorism, but the average person with no prior knowledge of Paul's case does not know that the trial was unfair. Paul did not have access to international counsel. He had his attorney-client privileged documents confiscated, and there was a violation of the presumption of innocence through public accusations at the highest levels of government, including Rwandan President Paul Kagame. He was subject to abuse, and his human rights and legal rights were violated. The reckless abandonment of due process by the Rwandan government cannot go unnoticed. The Rwandan government should be held accountable. Today, we plan to shed light on this unfair trial. Karine, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us on the show, Justin.
Let's start off talking about your father. Your father is, as far as Americans are concerned, your father's known as a key figure from the 2004 Academy Award-nominated movie Hotel Rwanda. There's a lot more to this that we don't see in the movie. It is I guess I could use the word classically trained hotel general manager in the hospitality industry in Kigali, the capital of Rwanda.
Yeah. So in the 90s, my father was a manager of a hotel, the Hotel de Mille Collines in Kigali, the capital of Rwanda. He had been working in the hotel industry for a few years, and when the genocide started at the beginning of April of 1994. At the time, I think when the genocide first started, my father and our family and neighbors were actually at our house, but somehow he was able to get everyone to the hotel. And from then on, more and more people came to the hotel looking for shelter. And he opened the doors for anyone, any victims that needed protection, that needed space or somewhere to stay during or to hide during during the genocide, as people were being killed with machetes all around the hotel. My father was able to protect them, to keep them safe. He did so by calling everyone around the world that he could, authorities, U.S. authorities, French authorities, anyone that he could every time that the entire Hamwais, which are the genocide perpetrators, would try to go into the hotel and kill the people who were hiding inside. And he would also use his charm and his the favors he had accumulated over the years to tell them to go away one more day, to go away one more day. And then he did so for 76 days. After 76 days, everyone, over 1,268 people that he had protected during the genocide, were evacuated to a refugee camp outside of Kigali. And that is what you see in the hotel, in Hotel Rwanda.
Your father did this with not only through the relationships that he had as being the general manager of the hotel, but also through what I would call marginal support or protection from UN observer forces. Is that correct?
That's correct. There was some help from the UN stopping the Inchar Hamwais from coming in, but it was through the help of all these people that he had been contacting and been trying to get to pay attention to the killings that were happening in the country, that of course he also had relationships with some of these people. So he was able to cash in that favor and ask them not to come in and kill people inside the hotel. And so, as I mentioned, this went on for 76 days.
How many Rwandans did your father assist in saving? I wanted to say is credited for, but your father would never say that he took credit for saving lives.
That's correct. So my father protected 1,268 lives. And I like what you said, because my father really does not see himself as a hero. He sees himself as an ordinary man. And he truly believes that anyone who would have been put in this situation, who would have had the powers of, I mean, a hotel, or access to a hotel and keys, he really thinks that any ordinary person like himself could have done the same thing or should have done the same thing. And that's why he's continued to call himself an ordinary man and doesn't see what he did as a heroism, although I believe so, and I think many people around the world believe it as well.
The genocide as we know it is, according to some historical records, they say it ended 15 July 94 when the RPF entered Kigali and stopped the killings. In those 100 days, estimates range from 500,000 to 1.2 million Rwandans were killed. Your family stayed in Rwanda at a very delicate time. How long did you guys stay in Rwanda before eventually making the decision to go to Tanzania?
So my biological parents were actually among those killed during the Rwandan genocide. I was adopted by Paul Rusesabagina and Tatiana. They're biologically my aunt and uncle, but they've adopted me as their daughter since I was 1 year old at the time. But we actually didn't stay to the genocide. People started, at the end of it, people started moving back into their homes and trying to reconstruct the country. But it wasn't a matter of a few days. It wasn't months or so, because the country needed to be rebuilt. And that's when more trouble, of course, continued.
Would you consider your father active in part of that reconciliation, or at least part of the healing process from that time to what a lot of Americans look at as the democratization of, or what we thought would be the democratization of Rwanda?
So I think my father hoped that the new government would be bringing in democracy, would be bringing justice and peace and reconciliation to Rwanda. However, this obviously was not the case. And immediately after the genocide, reports of RPF killings were already being put out. People who had lost their families because of the RPF were testifying and giving their stories. And so this, my father quickly understood that this regime was very much identical to the previous one. But because, as my father is a Hutu, Rwanda, as you know, has two major ethnic groups. There are Hutus and Tutsis. He's a Hutu who's also married to a Tutsi. He sheltered in the hotel, the 1,268 people included both Hutus and Tutsis. So my father in Rwanda and among Rwandans is considered a unifying figure because of not only his because of his origins, his love for all people, but also the fact that that he doesn't see a difference and he considers all humans to be equal and right. should have the same opportunities, access, and so on. The new regime that took over did not believe reconciliation to be a priority. And my father, from the beginning, immediately became vocal on the need for reconciliation among Hutus and Tutsis and the need for setting the record straight and telling the right. truth about what happened in order for the Rwandan people to truly reconcile and move forward and to reconstruct the nation. And the way that we know that this is not what they truly wanted is that my father, who had already saved many lives during the genocide, was immediately targeted after the genocide. And the new government attempted to kill him while we were still in Rwanda. That was shortly 1996, shortly after the genocide. And that is only because they considered him to be a Hutu leader in opinion and a person who can have success and who's unifying and that could somehow get in the way of their want, their desire to hold on to power, or to keep or have power. And so they tried to eliminate him even after he had already done so much for the country. And that is at the moment that we decided to flee and move to Belgium because of the assassination attempts right. and the fact that our lives were in danger.
Let's talk about that for a second, Karine, if we can. The current president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, was your father originally supportive of Paul Kagame? It seems that Paul Kagame had this almost allure from the West, or had almost, you know, mesmerized us about not only talk of reconciliation, but true democracy and how Rwanda could be a bastion for democracy.
I don't know, frankly, what he believed before, but what I know for a fact is that quickly after the genocide, it was the signs were clear that this man, Paul Kagame, was not there to unite the country, to reconcile the country. It wasn't it. And because of the reports of the killings, the really brutal and violent and killings that were allegedly perpetrated by the Rwandan, the current Rwandan government. And so even with the hopes, and I think many Rwandans also hoped for change and hoped for a democratic country that is fair to all ethnic groups and all people. And I think the hope was there for everyone, including my father, including anyone who just wanted to have a better country. However, as I mentioned, this quickly was changed when the reports of the killings of this government as well started coming to light.
Brian, I'd like to go to you real quickly on this subject, because, you know, again, my recollection is that Paul Kagame was kind of propped up by the West as being this advocate for true African democracy. That, you know, he embraced true democratization in the country, talked of reconciliation, was saying all the right things. Where did the West kind of get it wrong, or were we just sold kind of a bill of goods by Paul Kagame, and he's no different than any other autocratic leader we've seen in Africa?
Thanks for having us on, Justin. And your last comment's the most appropriate, I think. We were sold a bill of goods. I would say Kagame is different than other autocrats in Africa because he's better at it. And he played the game with the West. So when he came in, as an example, he led the rebel forces that won a four-year civil war and came in and ended the genocide and chased the previous regime that had started everything out. At that point in time, he didn't take the presidency himself. He took a vice president's role, and he put in a quote-unquote reconciliation government with a Hutu president. Kagame is a Tutsi. He took the vice president role in the head of the military. But as Corrine said, it took almost no time for people to realize this. Paul Rusesabagina has actually said to me at the very beginning, he viewed Paul Kagame as the guy coming in on the white horse to save everyone. And what he and others inside the country realized, and a few human rights groups realized very early, including some reporters at the UN, but it didn't get through to the UN administration, they realized Kagame wasn't really interested in reconciliation. By 1995 and then by the end of 1996, the Hutus in the government started being pushed out of government. And at that point in time, corruption was the charge du jour. If you wanted to get rid of someone, now it's more likely to be supporting rebels or supporting terrorists if you want to get rid of someone there. Kagame himself, though, didn't take the presidency until the year 2000. So he kept up that facade of democratization.
So with that, Corrine, let me go back to you, for example. Your father has been critical of the Rwandan central government and President Paul Kagame. This has been a longstanding conflict with the Kagame administration. Am I correct in that assessment?
Yes, they have been coming after him for many years now, and very much so since the movie Hotel Rwanda was released.
One of the things that we want to talk about is currently Kagame has brought in a lot of economic powers. There's a lot of IT infrastructure that's being developed in there. There's a lot of American companies that have been encouraged to do investment in that part of the continent. When we look at what the West had been sold, what the West had promoted versus what we're seeing today, your father saw this potential conflict as far as the economic development and the economic growth of Rwanda versus the selfish iterations of an autocratic leader like Paul Kagame. Your father started talking about this early on in the Kagame administration, which is where the conflict started. Is that correct, Corrine?
So where the conflict really started, when my father started being vocal about the need for reconciliation in Rwanda. He actually immediately after, in early 2000, he received the Immortal Chaplain Award that was awarded to him in Washington, D.C., and the Rwandan government sent an ambassador, their ambassador, to actually attend the event and give a good speech. However, a few years, and then they invited my father for awards as well to Rwanda. But my father at the time also already saw the dangers and was hesitant. However, in 2004, when Hotel Rwanda was released, that is when things completely changed. At first, I mean, just to back up a bit, between 2000 and 2004, the Rwandan government approached my father, offered him positions within his government, Paul Kagame wanting my father to work for the Rwandan government. They offered him ministership, ambassadorship, anything that he wanted. But my father refused because he believes in human rights. He has always advocated for human rights and reconciliation. And this is not something the Rwandan government was doing. And again, they were also known to have done a lot of brutal things. And so my father refused. And in 2005, when my father was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President George W. Bush. And that is when Paul Kagame lost it and essentially started publishing hundreds and hundreds of articles in the Rwandan newspapers, smearing my father, attacking him, calling him a genocide denier, which is a crime in Rwanda, a punishable crime by prison. And so really smearing him, trying to silence him, trying to discredit him, so that he not only loses the attention and the platform that he had gained through the release of the movie, but also to silence him because he was exposed exposing a lot of the crimes that the Rwandan government was responsible for, but he was also talking about the human rights abuses being committed by the Rwandan government and the need for reconciliation.
Karine, your father openly warned Bill Clinton and the Clinton Foundation in 2012 against the Clinton Foundation supporting Kagame in Rwanda. Can we talk about the basis of his claims and why even back then he was still very adamant that we should be very wary, cautious, or just forego support for Paul Kagame?
Hey, Justin, this is Kitty. Thank you so much for having us on. This is sort of where I came in, and it's kind of crazy that Paul Kagame, a president, would come after Paul Rusesabagina, a private citizen, because we wrote a few press releases and published an open letter criticizing the regime, the Kagame regime, whenever he would put human rights activists in jail or kill a journalist or, that's what happened with Clinton back in 2012. And when we wrote to Tony Blair and Bill Gates, much the same. But one thing I remember is in Brussels, Paul Kagame was supposed to give a speech about development to the annual European Development Days celebration in Brussels. And the day before, we put out a press release and sent it to the Nike PR people and the Gates Foundation PR people who were partnering with him on this. And we just simply recited some of the human rights abuses of the Kagame regime in the previous 3 or 6 months to that actual event. And I'm not certain who talked to who, but President Kagame ended up leaving Brussels before his keynote speech. Ah. That's a little bit what's going on today.
Right. And I want to lead up to that. But real quickly, Karine, I want to go to you. You'd mentioned the Presidential Medal of Freedom that was awarded to your father by President George W. Bush. A couple of things before we get into the current situation involving your father. Karine, your father is a permanent resident of the United States. He's a green card holder, as a green card holder residing in San Antonio, Texas. Is that correct?
He is a Belgian citizen and an American U.S. permanent U.S. permanent resident.
So, yeah. Okay. I want to get into the situation beginning 31 August 2020. Karine, can you kind of give us a snapshot of what happened on that day when your father was, for all intents and purposes, kidnapped, I think would be the right term.
Yes, but if that's okay, I'd like to go a bit backward before getting sure. to August 2020, because it's a lead up. This has been happening for over 15 years now, and this is the kidnapping and what's happened since August 2020 is very much has been building up, because the Rwandan government has been after him and trying to, as I mentioned, silence him, discredit him, smear him. But not only that, they've attempted to assassinate him. They have driven him off the road, off the road one time in Belgium, where his car flipped and he had to be transported to the hospital. They have broken into our home in Belgium several times, where they've destroyed everything. Threw around. We have a picture of my father receiving the medal with George Bush in our living room. They just took that picture off the wall and threw it on the floor, and it's a clear sign to us. Then they stole some documents in Kenya, Rwanda, but this wasn't a regular break-in. They were sending us a message.
Real quickly, Karine, when you say they, who do you mean?
The Rwandan government. So okay. Paul, so since Hotel Rwanda was released, Paul Kagame, just to back up again, Paul Kagame has wanted to brand himself as the hero of the Rwandan genocide. When Hotel Rwanda was released and my father was known as a hero internationally, Paul Kagame did not like this. Not only he tried to lure him in, to offer him jobs, position, my father refused, and instead continued to use his platform to advocate for human rights, justice, peace, and reconciliation. Because my father refused Kagame's approaches and because he also advocated for the human rights of people, Kagame has started going after him, where he tried to assassinate him. They've broken into our home. They've sent people to events where my father, conferences where my father was speaking all around the world to harass him, to intimidate him, to disturb the events. They've done everything possible to really get in his way, including attempting to assassinate him. But did that not work? In 2010, they started, and this is important because it comes back today, in that they started to ask and then charges against him. They were saying that he was funding rebel groups in the Congo and falsified transfer receipts that they sent to money transfer receipts that they sent to the Rwandan government and to the U.S. authorities and the Belgian authorities. But both authorities looked at those receipts and realized that they were falsified, and the dates of the receipts when they were saying that my father funded these groups, my father wasn't in the place that they claimed he was. And so the fact is, for many years we've been dealing with this up to August of 2020, right, while my father was on a trip. He was traveling through Dubai on his way to Burundi. My father was taken on a private jet that instead took him to Rwanda. On the private jet, he was drugged. And then upon arriving in Rwanda, he was tied up by the hands, the legs, he was blindfolded. They covered his mouth, his nose, where he could almost barely breathe, and threw him in the car and then took him to what my father refers to as a slaughterhouse, which is essentially one of the Rwandan torture houses for three days. And then afterwards, he was taken to paraded. This is kind of the images we saw internationally in the media at that time, is that he was brought in front of the Rwandan Investigation Bureau and shown to the media in an attempt to that smear campaign that I've said they've launched against him all these years.
Right.
This was essentially their opportunity to now parade him.
So let's address a couple of the questions regarding the claims made by the Kagame government in Rwanda, in particularly the Rwanda Investigation Bureau, or the RIB. I'm just going to ask you some really fast questions regarding that. Number one, your father is being accused of many charges. Is your father a terrorist?
My father is not a terrorist.
Has your father ever been accused outside of this of arson, kidnap, or any other felony crime such as that?
No, my father doesn't even have a parking ticket anywhere.
I'm going to ask this question, and please, Corinne, I'm asking this as objectively. Has your father ever, and I'm using the quote from the RIB, committed murder perpetrated against unarmed, innocent Rwandan civilians on Rwandan territory?
No, he has not. Okay. My father is a human rights defender,
which has been recognized globally, because we'll talk about that in a second. But your father's also been accused of being the founder, leader, sponsor, and this is a quote, the founder, leader, sponsor, and member of violent armed extremist terror outfits. Is your father the founder, leader, sponsor, or member of any violent armed extremist terror outfits, including the FLN and the MRCD?
No, he's not.
You have said recently that these you said recently that, and I quote, what they're accusing him of is all made up. There's no evidence to what they are claiming. We know that this is a wrongful arrest. To those that are listening here in the United States, tell us a little bit about what we're hearing in the arrest warrant and the court hearings out of Kigali versus what the reality is. Your father is an award-winning human rights advocate that has received the most distinguished award given to a civilian by the president of the United States, George W. Bush at the time. What do you say to Americans that, why is this important that Americans understand what's happening to your father and why we should be concerned?
Yeah, so these are all falsified charges. There are made up charges. As I mentioned, they've been making up charges against him since the movie Hotel Rwanda was released. And they were accusing him of being a genocide denier, accusing my father of being a genocide denier when he individually saved 1,268,000 lives during the genocide means that it is that they are ready to lie anything just to make their stories fit and to silence my father in order for him never to speak again and advocate for the rights of the Rwandan people. The reason why this is important is that for not only for the U.S., but for the international community, but specific to the U.S., is that what happens when you don't hold leaders accountable, when you don't challenge authoritarianism, when you don't challenge people who are willing to do crimes as violent as the ones Kagame has committed over the years, this is what happens, is that they will silence any person that is trying to advocate for the rights of the people that have been whose rights have been violated by those same authorities. And this is precisely what my father is a victim of. This is a victim of an authoritarian regime that is trying to silence him because he's a humanitarian talking for the people.
We have seen, now let's just be clear, the New York Center for Foreign Policy Affairs came out early. We put out a statement, made phone calls to support the release of Paul Rusesabagina immediately into either the custody of independent UN officials or into an independent country such as Switzerland or a third party. So to be clear about this, but when we started talking about this on social media, we got hit by what we can only anticipate is a PR regime out of Kigali. Talk a little bit about the drive of what is making what was once thought to be a shining light of democracy and a leader of democracy on the African continent to all of a sudden he's now just solely possessed by his own ego and PR. Brian, can you talk about this a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So as Kitty was saying, we are a small organization.
Right.
We were a small foundation with Paul, and we made as much noise as we could, but it was mostly press releases and speaking engagements and things like that. The pushback from the Rwandan government was incredible. One of the things we know about Paul Kagame is he is a dictator who bases his rule on silencing all dissent, not just dissenters within his country, but dissenters outside of the country. Since Paul's been in prison, since he was kidnapped, actually, Freedom House just published a report they'd been working on for a while talking about transnational repression. And Kagame is one of the poster children for transnational repression. He goes to extreme lengths to silence critics in other countries, whether it is kidnapping, whether it is threats and harassment, whether it is assassinations, some of which even against former high leaders of his country, some just against people who were speaking out. For about the past 10 years, I've been doing some legal work with a number of people as an advisor and expert witness who were falsely accused by Kagame of taking part in the genocide. And in the US and Canada and Netherlands and other European countries, Kagame provides evidence, most of which has no basis in reality, that people took part in the genocide, and other countries prosecute people for him. This is the way Kagame silences people. The democracy was really just something that was put on, and this is the true Paul Kagame.
Hey, Kitty, you want to jump in on that?
The amount of money that President Kagame spends from his government's budget to silence critics, not only but predominantly Paul Rusesabagina, is crazy. We had heard rumors years ago in 2012 when he was trying to propagate false charges against Paul Rusesabagina that he was paying a London PR firm about £500,000 per year. We know that this year they hired a PR firm out of Britain called Chellgate. And we know this because the Chellgate PR firm also accidentally leaked a media interview training tape to Al Jazeera, and it figures prominently in an interview of the Minister of Justice confessing to the fact that the Rwandan government paid for the plane that kidnapped Paul Rusesabagina. They paid Gainjet for that plane. It's an incredibly odd situation. I really don't know of any other government which spends this much time and energy, and you've been a victim of their troll farm. I just don't know any other government that spends this much effort on people in the diaspora. You know, Paul Rusesabagina hasn't been inside of Rwanda for decades. What is Paul Kagame afraid of?
Right. And I know that there has been this conflict between Paul and Kagame and the Kagame administration, but please go ahead, Kitty.
I just want to talk about the origins of that for a minute.
Sure.
You know, the problem started because Paul Rusesabagina was organizing dialogues between Rwandans in the diaspora. We were getting people together to talk about truth and reconciliation. Paul was asking the international community to get behind a truth and reconciliation commission for not only Rwanda, but the Great Lakes region of Africa. That was why Kagame was mad. That's the part I just can't understand.
Okay. And I want to go back to Corrine for a second, and I want to ask her, have you been able to communicate with your father since his kidnapping / arrest in August of last year?
Yes, we have a 5-minute phone call with him every week. Those 5-minute phone calls are very, very strange and very sad. My father is not speaking at ease. It sounds like he has Rwandan authorities around him. There are a lot of things that we cannot communicate to him and he cannot communicate to us by fear of what they could do to him. And he has been feeling sick. I mean, he has hypertension. He's a cancer survivor who hasn't had cancer screenings in now 2 years since he was kidnapped last year and missed it. He's missing it this year. He's 67 years old, and the conditions, he was held in solitary confinement for over 260 days. And the psychological impact this has on an individual is terrible. And not only that, but he was also tortured for 3 days, physically tortured.
Right.
And so he's not doing well. And those 5-minute phone calls we cherish them very much because we get to hear his voice, but we are worried for his life every single day.
Brian, talk to me a little bit about the allegations of torture. I mean, I want to be careful. Tell us about the situation regarding how you guys came to know that there was possible torture involved.
Absolutely. And it's a really tough story to tell. Paul had mentioned very early on, he had one interview with the New York Times and one with an African paper that were very brief and that were heavily monitored. This was in September, right, that he had been mistreated. And we know Kagame regime had him somewhere in an unknown location for almost 4 days. Mm-hmm. We know from Human Rights Watch, from Amnesty International and others that the Kagame regime regularly tortures prisoners, and we feared for the worst. He'd mentioned on one phone call to his family that there had been issues. We didn't know until about 2 months ago now the details of the torture. He could not talk about it on the phone. As Corrine said, those calls are monitored. And he had no contact with lawyers of his choosing for the first 2.5 months of the trial. He had no one he could trust. The Kagame regime forced lawyers on him. Finally, we have now two local lawyers who've been hired by the family. They hardly have any time to see him. They're often barred from going in. They are searched when they go in. Their documents are confiscated, both when they go in and when they go out. They really have no lawyer-client confidentiality privileges at all. Part of the privileges, though, went downhill after Paul was able to give one of his lawyers testimony about the torture. And this was, to me at least, an incredibly brave thing on Paul's side. And I'll challenge everyone on this. How often do you hear about someone who is tortured in prison who talks about it while they're in prison?
Right.
It simply doesn't happen. And Paul chose to do this because he thought it was so important. He got the story out to us. We confirmed it with the discussions with the lawyers. We were able to ask a few questions back and forth. But what we know is some of the things that Corrine said. He was taken to a place that he called a slaughterhouse. He was held there, bound in what are obviously, from his description, stress positions. He was unable to move. He stated that he had to be carried, helped to stand up and to go to the bathroom, and had to be held up when he was defecating. He stated that there were several occasions where he's lying on the ground, imagine yourself bound with your arms and legs behind your back, and then they put tape or something else over your mouth and nose to suffocate you. And on one occasion, he described that they didn't take it off until his legs were shaking and he was basically out of oxygen. And then also on another occasion, Paul described that one of his jailers, while the tape was on his mouth and nose, put a boot on his neck on the ground, held him down, and said, "We know how to torture you."
What we're hearing from both Corrine and you, Brian, are just horrendous violations of human rights, violations of what many thought were basic legal rights in Rwanda. Is anybody looking into this from a violation of human rights or international law?
There are actually many who are, and we're extremely grateful for it. Unfortunately, it doesn't include a lot of the most important governments that could have a hand in this. So we almost immediately filed with the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture. We have filed with the UN Special Rapporteur on Arbitrary Detentions, and they have both taken up the case and are talking with the Rwandan government. Most of that happens behind the scenes. That's usually not done in public. Human Rights Watch has been very active in public about this. The American Bar Association actually has been fantastic here. They work with the Clooney Foundation for Human Rights, and we're very pleased that Amal and George Clooney chose to become involved with their foundation. They have now published 2 separate reports, and this is a group that goes in and only looks at the what are likely to be the worst of the worst cases. They rarely publish reports in advance of a case concluding. They decided in Paul's case that they needed to publish preliminary reports to show what has happened and what has gone on at this trial and all of the violations throughout the time. Effectively, everyone at every turn, every one of Paul's legal rights has been taken away or completely ignored, from access to lawyers, to humanitarian treatment, to solitary confinement, to the way the trial's gone on, over and over and over again. And the ABA and Clooney Foundation have filed dozens of pages there. We have a number of other international lawyers groups. The European Union Parliament has jumped in with a resolution, Spanish Parliament. We have been seeing very good support, but so far it has not led to the action to get Paul free.
Kitty, you know, this is a U.S. Medal of Freedom awardee, a permanent resident green card holder of the United States, a Belgian citizen that is now being held questionably legally in Rwanda, in a Rwandan jail. And we even saw a letter go out with John Cornyn and Patrick Leahy, a bipartisan letter, go to Secretary Blinken. Why are we not seeing more action on this? I mean, we've got George Clooney involved.
Right. This is what, you know, I've worked around government and advocating with government for years. And honestly, I am completely shocked about the fact that Paul was kidnapped. He is an innocent man. And, you know, the more the trial goes on, the more we find out that the charges are just completely trumped up. And I am personally shocked, not about the humanitarian groups, Human Rights Watch, everybody that Brian mentioned, the Lantos Foundation, the Edelstam Foundation, the Freedom House. I'm not so surprised about the people who jumped in to help. What I am truly horrified about is that neither the United States State Department nor the Belgian Foreign Ministry have stepped up and said, this is our permanent resident, this is our citizen, you kidnapped him, you cannot take someone like this, you need to send him home immediately. You know, and remember, all this torture, everything that's going on, this is not a man who has been sent to prison. This is an innocent man awaiting judgment. Look at what they've done to him while he is an innocent man. Imagine if this sham trial finds him guilty, what will they do to him then?
So, Kitty, Brian, and obviously Corrine, this begs the question. We, as of this date, have not seen, heard, or read about any reports from either the intelligence community or the criminal justice community here in the United States that would give any indication that the charges against Paul Rusesabagina are in fact even remotely true. Why the hesitancy, particularly with not just one, but now two letters, the one from 29 June and the one from back in 2020? What is the hesitancy of the U.S. government to get involved and call for the release of Paul?
Yeah, I think there are a number of things going on, Justin. The first was early on, there were questions of could he actually be guilty? And a number of people, most people, know nothing about Rwanda and don't understand that this is a place where people are falsely accused on a regular basis if you're a critic of the human rights violations of the government and don't understand what the government can do. So we had to educate people about that. And I think the education campaign was broadly successful. And then it took time for the governments to step in. And one of the things that we've run into is a lot of bureaucracy. Who's in charge? Who's the right person to do this? And about the time that we were getting through the bureaucracy, the election was happening. And it was almost impossible to get the U.S. to do anything during the election season. And then President Trump loses and has a lame duck for a couple of months. And now the Biden administration's come in, and while a number of people have talked about helping, and we think there are some good things that can be happening in the future, that first 100 or 200 days of a new administration, it's hard to get their foreign, to get on their foreign policy priorities. So we've been seeing bureaucracy that is hurting a man's health and life, and that's getting in the way of a man's health and life here. And then you also look at Belgium. For the first 3 months that he was in prison, Belgium had no government, and their government was just getting settled in after that. And Belgium has a very complicated relationship with Rwanda, and that's led them to be less than helpful on a number of different occasions. So it is incredibly frustrating for the team and family, knowing what we know, seeing what we see, having the support from the human rights and legal communities, and still needing to continue to push and push and push. The United States government could get Paul out with a word or a sentence. Right. They have an enormous amount of influence there.
Yes, I just wanted to add as well that one other thing that the Rwandan government does, and they spend so much resources on this and smear campaigns on PR and propaganda. Every single person that advocates for my father on social media gets attacked by an army of trolls from the Rwandan government. Any person who advocates for us gets bombarded with insults, with attacks against themselves. Journalists who write in favor of my father also get sent people. So as what Brian and Kitty were describing, this is an added factor that they have a huge propaganda machine, and they're spending a lot of money in PR firms to wash up everything on teams of trolls and internet trolls to attack people who defend us. And so this is to say, this also plays into the hesitation of people to come in and help immediately, because they're also being attacked by the.
You got to see some of the postings they did when we posted about this on Twitter. My goodness.
They have an amazing PR machine, and Paul Kagame is completely enmeshed in this. We know from people who've worked in his office and directly for him and are out of the country now, he not only gets reports on the media every morning, he's actively involved in it. He gets incredibly mad at his staff when negative media comes out and pushes them to keep the media positive. He's threatened ambassadors who don't do their jobs and silencing dissenters. That's one of the jobs of a Rwandan ambassador, is to keep the critics in the country that they're in quiet,
right?
And whether they're Rwandans or not. So this is a country that's really fixated on this.
Yes, I just wanted to add one more point, is that Rwanda is the 18th, according to the IMF report this April, Rwanda is the 18th poorest country in the world, yet they're wasting so many resources in attacking human rights defenders, kidnapping human rights defenders, and attacking human rights advocates on social media, like all of us.
We've seen and heard a lot of American, particularly tech companies, go into Rwanda. The number of data centers, and we're talking big companies. We know Microsoft, Google, Apple, all have some sort of presence, Oracle, all have some sort of presence in Kigali, and they have operations in Rwanda. It was known, I guess, at one time as a data hub for the African continent. Is there any way that we could see a conflict between those companies doing, is there pressure perhaps that they could put on the Kagame administration, or do we need to put pressure on those companies?
I think we need to put pressure on those companies. And it's a lot of it is business as usual and people wanting to keep business as usual. We need to realize that even though this is an autocratic government with huge human rights problems, it's also a great place for Westerners to invest. And Kagame made sure of that. Right. There's no standard African-style corruption where people have their hands out all the time and you have to bribe everyone. That doesn't exist in Rwanda. What exists, though, is one main company, Crystal Ventures, that is owned by Kagame and his associates, with a lot of offshoots that run everything in the country. And when foreign investors and foreign companies come in, they deal with those Kagame-backed companies, and they get great treatment, and they don't have the normal corruption hassles that come with working in the country. It just so happens only a few people are profiting from it. And that's where the way that corruption looks in Rwanda, but it doesn't bother American businesses. So I don't think that it's so much that they are backing him or stopping any. Thing, they just would be needed to put pressure on. We could use assistance there in putting more pressure on for human rights.
And Karine, Kitty, Brian, we've only got a few more minutes left. I could do this for another hour, but we are, as of this date of production on the 20th of July, we are hearing reports of your organization or a hacking incident. Am I misreading this?
That's correct. A forensics expert, a team of forensics experts from Amnesty International Security Lab based in Germany. They're very much similar to Citizen Lab in Canada, if you're familiar with the organization. They conducted forensics on my phone and discovered that I had the Pegasus spyware, which is a spyware started by NSO Group, an Israeli firm. However, we obviously believe it to be the Rwandan government who is spying on me. The software itself has, very strong capabilities in reading. They can read my messages, my text messages, my emails, listen into my phone calls, press record or videotape me on conversations that I had in the room without me ever knowing this. But what's most startling for me is, especially, not only is this a violation of my human rights and invasion of my privacy, but the scariest part is the threats to my father's life. I communicated with our whole team, with Kitty and Brian all day, and our legal team and our family on legal strategies, on ways to help my father, with diplomatic individuals, with the U.S. State Department, the U.K. High Commission, the Belgian authorities, the Belgian government, and all of these people have been spied on through me, through my phone, through the conversation that I've had with them. And we believe it to be the Rwandan government. And this has started in January, according to the forensics report. It began in January, and this is way after my father had been kidnapped. So if in fact their allegations weren't invented, why is there a need to come and spy on me and spy on our entire family and our legal team and our team? And so it's really, it's scary, it's frightening. But this again shows you the type of how much resources the Rwandan government is wasting, but also the extent of which the Rwandan government is willing to go to silence people.
Obviously, this is something I'm anticipating that the U.S. government, the State Department, and Secretary Blinken will be notified of this report being in existence. That's totally shocking to me. We got a couple more minutes left, and I've got to ask this question. Number one, Karine, is there anything our listeners can do to help either in the efforts or to help secure the release of your father from Rwandan custody?
Yes. So you can write to your representatives and ask them to put urgency on Secretary Blinken and President Biden to bring my father home to to San Antonio, Texas. We're lucky that the U.S. government, the special presidential envoy for hostage affairs has taken my father's case, and therefore the U.S. government considers my father to be an illegal detainee. However, we need the U.S. government to step up and bring him home quickly, because he's sick. He's been tortured both physically and emotionally and mentally, and he needs us now. He saved so many lives, and everyone has the capability to write an email, to make a phone call to your representatives and ask them to help save Paul Rusesabagina. Another thing you can do is also advocate on social media. We know that Paul Kagame reads every single tweet. He reads most tweets, actually, and he reads things, and he gets angry by seeing things like this, at least. And the voices that can come, that can be heard and seen in support of my father through via social media is one that would have, that will have an impact. And so I encourage everyone to tweet at hashtag Free Recessa Begina and at Free the Hero, but especially tag Paul Kagame as well, because he will see your tweets.
Ah, and Kitty, anything you'd like to add to that?
Just what Corinne was saying, hashtag Free Recessa Begina. Our Twitter is at Free the Hero, but President Kagame, that's Paul Kagame, and I believe it's even at Paul Kagame, does read his Twitter. He reads press. And Brian, can you just mention about Legal Aid?
Sure. First, let's get our foundation website out.
Right.
Because it has all of this information on it, Justin, and we keep it up to date with news and press releases and all the reports we put out. That's hrrfoundation.com. And then we've been doing fundraising for Paul's Legal Defense Fund through a group called LegalerAid.org, LegalerAid.org. And there's a picture of Paul Recessa Begina and talks about his case. It is really expensive to have a legal team put together, and the family is not wealthy. Paul had a small fee from Hotel Rwanda, but he did not become rich off of it. So there are a lot of costs associated with trying to do this and move forward. And then I totally agree that keeping Paul in the press, whether it's social media or in the mainstream press, is huge. And part of that is that we haven't talked about, this is a way to put pressure on Kagame. It's not just that we need to get the U.S. and or Belgium actively involved in pushing to get him out, but it's important to make this hard on Paul Kagame and to make him realize he's made a mistake in taking Paul Recessa Begina, and it's going to be easier to give him back than it is to keep him in custody, and that the world is actively watching.
Right. Corinne, obviously our love to your father. You know that the support of the center is absolutely there. We're going to be putting these links up on our podcast page. We'll be putting this up on our homepage at nycfpa.org. But Corinne, Kitty, Brian, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Justin. We really appreciate the support.
It really means a lot, Justin. Thank you so much.
You got it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
For more information on the subject you just heard about, or any of our articles, reports, or events, log on to nycfpa.org. Also, please consider subscribing to Message Traffic on your favorite podcast service like Apple, Google, Spotify, or TuneIn Radio. You can also follow us on social media by searching for us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. For questions regarding the center, or just to let us know what you were thinking, you can email us at info@nycfpa.org. On behalf of the board and staff of the New York Center for Foreign Policy Affairs, thank you for listening.